This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Thanks for starting your week with us. We begin today in New York City. We're back in February of this year. A community was in mourning.
We deserve to be safe, not feel safe, but be safe in our city, in our home.
You're hearing Susan Lee, a resident in New York City's Chinatown neighborhood and currently a candidate for the New York City Council. Susan was speaking during a community rally following the brutal slaying of Christina Yuna Lee. Now, days earlier, Christina, who's not related to Susan, was stabbed to death in her own apartment. A college graduate and creative digital producer, Christina was just 35 years old when a man she did not know followed her to her home, pushed his way into her apartment, and took her life with stunning brutality. The unthinkable violence against Christina came just weeks after the shocking killing of Michelle Goh. Just 40 years old, Michelle was waiting on the platform in the Times Square subway station when a man pushed her in front of an oncoming train. The deadly crime against Michelle Goh occurred in New York, but the reverberation was felt across the nation. After Michelle's death, Russell Jung, a co-founder of Stop AAPI Hate, spoke with Fox 2 in San Francisco.
I think in our community, like, people are 1 degree from separation from knowing someone who's been attacked or assaulted.
From March 2020 to December 2021, the advocacy coalition Stop AAPI Hate received nearly 11,000 reports of hate incidents against Asian American and Pacific Islanders. It's no wonder that many in Asian American communities are feeling the grief and fear of living just 1 degree of separation from violence. In her recent piece for The Nation, Sex, Death, and Empire, The Roots of Violence Against Asian Women, Panthea Lee, ethnographer, activist, and writer, interrogates a long history of sexualized and gendered violence against Asian women. She finds the root of contemporary anti-Asian hate are far deeper than COVID-era rhetoric. And when she finds a 38-second video from the summer of 2020 on her own iPhone, Panthea discovers she was less than 1 degree removed from Christina Yuna Lee, whose startling murder in February rocked New York's Chinatown. I sat down with Panthea Lee to discuss her article. And just a heads up as we talk about this, the reality is Asian American and Pacific Islander women face violence and hear some pretty horrible things. So part of our conversation will include some of that strong language.
What I started looking at as I was sort of digging through this history of sexualized violence against Asian women was I started looking back at U.S. military history. I started looking at the Philippine-American War, for example, at the end of the 19th century, a war that devastated the country, the Philippines, and where women who had never considered sex work were forced into it as a matter of economic survival. Now, the U.S. military encouraged this, and they actually justified officially sanctioned and managed sex work as a matter of military and imperial necessity. The thinking was that GIs would need a sexual outlet in the military theater, and so we need to get that set up for them, and then also to manage and inspect women so that they don't get sick. So the U.S. government basically said, this is a practical matter of manpower and of empire. We need our men to be healthy and to be able to fight. And so they registered women as sex workers, regularly tested them for disease, and tagged them like pets, reinforcing their status as less than human. And so there's a long military history here, but basically, you know, by the end of U.S. colonization in the Philippines, about 50 years later, this ideology had spread across Asia, laying the foundation for the region's now infamous sex entertainment and trafficking industries. And for me, the line from America's earliest empire there through wars in Japan, Korea and Vietnam, and now to the surge of anti-Asian violence here at home, is straight, it is clear, and it is written in blood.
The differing interpretations of the letters R and R.
Yeah. So, you know, in 1950, the U.S. military introduced a program called R&R, which is officially rest and recuperation, that gave soldiers breaks from active duty by sending them on holiday. And so it started shuttling soldiers, for example, daily to Japan. Now, soldiers' slang for R&R, calling it rape and run, rock and ruin, show us what many actually ended up doing with this time. And basically, you know, by the time the U.S. entered Vietnam, about a year after, Senator William Fulbright declared Saigon has become an American brothel. By the time U.S. left, there were about 500,000 prostitutes in the country. And so, you know, really, I think the system of trying to give men reprieve from active duty and then treating Asian women as the outlets by which they will do so has caused enormous harm all across Asia. And now we see the impacts on Asian women in America today.
I want you to speak a bit more about the nature of these harms and their interconnection. On the one hand, it seems obvious what the harms of sexual exploitation, sexual abuse, sexual violence, sex as a war crime are. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also worth not doing suffering pornography, but worth really understanding the multiplicative ways that this harm manifests.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I really appreciate that question. I think that the most obvious that we have seen now is obviously the surge in violence against Asian women. You know, I mean, in New York City, where I live, you know, just about a month ago, we saw a 67-year-old woman punched 125 times as she was coming home. About a week before that, a man assaulted 7 women on the streets of Manhattan as he was walking around over the course of a 2-hour period. And so I think these are the incidents that get the media attention. But I think the reality is that there's also the simultaneous hypersexualization and dehumanization of Asian women that has been reinforced through mass culture plays out in our day-to-day lives, from the racist catcalls that we get on the street to how we are treated in professional settings. There is a very specific type of marginalization that I think Asian women face. I mean, all women have their experiences of creepy men, of discrimination, of glass ceiling, but I think Asian women sort of face a very specific kind. In my piece, I ended up taking a look at an Instagram account, for example, that is dedicated solely to capturing the racist pickup lines received by Asian women on dating sites. I'm not sure how much of this I can repeat on public radio, but you know, I think some of the comments, I want to try my first Asian woman. I need my yellow fever cured. I will eat you like shrimp fried rice. All of these show how Asian women are seen as objects to fulfill male fantasy. And I do think the point around yellow fever is worth, you know, looking at a bit more deeply. This concept, you know, that I think many of us might sort of laugh about nowadays, it's sort of slang for people that have a specific sexual preference for Asian people. This kind of came out of basically a concept from the father of modern gynecology that insisted there was a unique strain of syphilis in Asian women. So our bodies have been seen as the sites of disease. We saw how the military has tested Asian women for disease. We saw how the Page Act of 1875 was the first restrictive federal immigration law in the U.S., which prohibited the entry of Chinese women because they were thought to be all diseased prostitutes. And so the idea that our bodies are the sites of disease, the idea that yellow fever is rampant and something that needs to be cured, persists today. And I think we can see connections between that idea and the ideologies that have been espoused by mass shooters around why they need to go and shoot and kill Asian women, for example, in the case of the Atlanta spa shootings.
I kept having this experience of recognition and familiarity while reading your piece, and I, in part, was trying to resist it because it is the danger of always reading the experience of other groups through your own and thinking, oh, yep, that's just like us. Oh, yeah, us too. And the ways in which that can actually be belittling or diminishing. But the section you were just walking us through on yellow fever, and of course the ways that Black folks have used the description of jungle fever in a similar way to talk about white people with a particular sexual preference for Black partners. But maybe most critically, that moment of recognition when you name check J. Marion Sims, as you say, understood as the father of modern gynecology, but becomes the father of that gynecology through experimentation on enslaved women's bodies. So what is the value here in seeing not only the window, but the mirror of experience between Asian women and African women in the U.S. and African American women and Asian American women relative to sexual violence?
I think that's such a good and important question. You know, to me, I think right now, we are seeing politicians and right-wing pundits using the attacks on Asian Americans and Asian American women to advance their carceral arguments and dehumanize Black people and delegitimize Black Lives Matter as a movement. And so I think we first need to recognize and to fight back against that. None of us should be pawns for white supremacy. Yes, Asian women are hurting, but we also need to understand the root causes of violence and stand in solidarity with all our sisters and brothers who suffer under it, especially Black women. Absolutely, you know, the quote unquote father of modern gynecology, his cruel experimentation on Black women, his declaration that there was a unique strain of Chinese toxin, of syphilis that was manifest in the bodies of Chinese women. All of these racist and misogynistic ideologies of women of color are what continue to perpetuate our suffering today. And these ideas have been reinforced through mass culture time and again. And so I think it is imperative that we sort of recognize the common roots of this racism and try and understand how do we actually, you know, build understanding that our, while our marginalization is specific and unique to each of us, the histories and the sources of this are actually shared.
As you talk about the propagation of these stereotypes, of these violent ideas in mass culture, say a bit more about media, about art, about film, and the ways that it has sexualized Asian women and also dehumanized.
Yeah. So I started looking deeper into how the stereotype of Asian women as docile, as compliant, as hypersexualized, existing solely to service men has played out over literature, theater, music, you know, and I looked back, for example, and thanks to the scholar, Dr. Celine Perinas Shimizu, looked back at the book Madame Chrysanthemum, published by a French writer in 1887 about a naval officer who goes to Japan, takes a temporary wife who he believed, quote, has no thoughts whatsoever. She was merely an object for his collection. And this book, I think the, you know, cultural significance of it cannot be understated. This dehumanization, and she ends up killing herself because she bears his child, the love is unrequited, he goes back and marries a white woman. This story has inspired basically a series of operas and plays and films over the last century. Madame Butterfly, Miss Saigon, Toll of the Seas. While the locations and the settings changed in line with Western geopolitical interests, the story remained the same. And so Dr. Shimizu is the one who sort of tuned me in and to this line of thinking. And her analysis is basically that these films and these plays, they're the manifestations of Western, usually white, male desire for these servile, submissive, suffering women who are sexy because they are servile, submissive, and suffering. And so, you know, we've seen this play out in Stanley Kubrick's film, Full Metal Jacket, about American Marines in Vietnam. And the line, a prostitute saying, me so horny, me love you long time. I mean, ask any Asian woman. This catcall has been used time and again. And it was sampled by Two Live Crew in their big hit, Me So Horny, which reached number one on the Billboard Rap Songs chart. And so, you know, we sort of see this, you know, there's memes about Me So Horny. And so I think we sort of continue to see this in the cultural waters that we're now swimming in to the point where it feels almost invisible. It's like a punchline. And Asian women are the punchline.
So let's, I want to focus in on the policy piece for a moment, because one of the important things you do is to shift our focus away from the focus shifting discourse of public policy leaders. And you talk about the ways that mental illness gets introduced into the conversation as a kind of hand-waving explanation for violence against Asian and Asian American women. So help us to understand how it is that conversations about mental illness actually move us away from having the conversations we need to have.
Yes. So as we've seen, we have seen officials and elected officials treating these attacks and these murders as isolated incidences, as exceptions to the norm, the work of mentally ill individuals. But mental illness is a red herring meant to distract us from the truth. And the truth is that these attacks are an epidemic that was seeded and nurtured by the American state and by American culture. And we're seeing Asian communities paying the price. So when asked for comment about Christina Lee's murder, New York City Mayor Eric Adams replied that the city must do more to address mental illness. But I've been to far too many rallies around stopping Asian hate and vigils for slain Asian women that I can't go anymore. It's become a political circus that is disrespectful to these women, to their lives, to their families, where officials line up to lament yet another tragedy, say, this must stop, point the finger at mental illness, and then hang around for photo ops. But the thing is, treating perpetrators as aberrations, as if they are deviants from the norm, really misses the point. Because mental illness operates within specific cultural contexts. And I actually interviewed a forensic psychiatrist who has treated the most violent of offenders around this. And the mentally ill still draw upon existing cultural templates, which they may distort or act upon in more extreme ways. And so when it comes to Asian women, the cultural template has long been dehumanization and sexual denigration. And so I think that, you know, for officials and, you know, some of the media reporting that we're seeing around this, repeatedly denying the role of race while pointing the finger at mental illness really just serves to absolve the state of responsibility. But these attacks are not strange coincidences. They're not just the actions of crazy people. And we are seeing actually where the state has fallen short. You know, Marshall Simon, the man who pushed Alyssa Goh to her death in the Times Square subway, he'd been in and out of hospitals for years. The New York Times found that in 2017, a psychiatrist at a state mental institution had noticed that Simon had said it was just a matter of time before he would push a woman onto the tracks. Despite this, he was still discharged. So who is to blame here? Is it the mentally ill or the systems that should be taking care of them? And are these lone instances? Is Marshall Simon an exception from the norm? Is Asamah Nash, who plunged a knife 40 times into Christina Lee, an exception? Is Steve Zajonc, who assaulted 7 women through Manhattan, an exception? Is Tamela Esco, who punched an Asian elder 125 times, an exception? You know, are the 10 attacks on Asian women every single day in this country, are they all exceptions? Because if every single one of these attacks is an exception, then I guess we must be living in some exceptional times.
You write in this piece about some real brutality, some of which you just walked us through. And yet I have to say the part that I think has kept me up is about your own contemplation of the third rail. You write about you and your partner having a plan A, B, and C if you are pushed onto the tracks.
Yeah, I think after the death of Alyssa Goh, I think a lot of women I knew were very shook. And, you know, obviously I live in New York. I take the subway on a regular basis. It got a bit hard. And, you know, so we started walking through what I would do if I were ever pushed onto the tracks. We have 3 options. Plan A is to stand almost like underneath the ledge where there is space to tuck myself under as the train passes by. My partner pointed out that some stations have almost these like little cutouts into the walls, you know, for service workers, but that I could sort of stand and hide in. And before Alyssa's death, I never noticed them. And now when I enter into stations, I just look for them. You know, the plan B is to run as fast as I can until I get in front of the train before where it might stop so I can, you know, get out of the way and get the conductor's attention. And then the third option is to, yeah, lie between the tracks of the train and put my head under. So I don't know how it's kind of morbid. But yeah, we've sort of talked through these. And then my partner has also mentioned that there is a third rail, which is basically where all the electricity runs through that the trains pull and drive on. And he cautioned me to never touch it. You know, one quick touch and you're gone. And, you know, in some of these moments now where I've been waiting for the train and not listening to music anymore, trying to look all around me and just like, I don't want to live like this. But I've also considered, if I were ever in a really bad situation, you know, would a quick touch that apparently I wouldn't even feel, would that be much better than a lot of other ways to go? It's not where I want my brain to go, but yeah, it's certainly something I've considered.
And then it turns out that 2 years ago, you caught Christina Lee right there on your own phone.
Yeah. So after her death, I learned that Christina and I had actually indeed met. I was hanging out on my stoop one evening, and this is summer 2020, and she was doing the same on my neighbor's stoop, just one door over. So it was a brief but sweet moment. And I think it was such a surprising and shocking realization, and I write about it in the Nation piece, but I think, you know, ultimately, while that moment was small, it led me after her death to explore these larger questions around the patterns and the history that we're seeing around anti-Asian violence. The media and the reporting were really just focused on the really gruesome details of her death, because I guess that's what sells. And I really wanted to know what her life was like, what she was like, and then also the factors and the history that have led us to these moments and that continue to absolve the state of responsibility or to, you know, advance crime and punishment and carceral agendas without actually addressing the root causes of what is harming us.
Panthea Lee, ethnographer, activist, writer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Melissa. I really appreciated the conversation.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.